Right, just gone 1:30, 1:31 if you're keeping an eye on the clock on this Easter Sunday. And we're going to go to motorsport, more importantly to Formula One. And Derek Canning of P1 Predict, after all our talk of Verstappen, he let us down very badly last weekend.
Are you, John? He did indeed, and it made it for a bit more interesting viewing, I guess. And it's also answered the question pretty early on about whether Red Bull are going to win every race this season. They're not. So the three laps in, Verstappen has to retire the car. They find out that a brake caliper had seized from the start of the race, and he had been racing for the first three laps with a seized brake. And it was quite obvious because we could see Carlos Sainz challenging him and overtaking him for the first two races, or for the first two laps, which was quite interesting and exciting to see, because it felt like Ferrari were up there. Verstappen retires the car, and amazingly, 16 days after getting his appendix out, Carlos Sainz goes on to win the race and wins it pretty comfortably too.
Yeah, it was. I was fascinated by it because, I mean, I did get up to watch it, and to be honest with you, I was saying, okay, I'll get up, watch the first five laps, and then I might doze on the couch and get the finish. But actually, you couldn't take your eyes off it, especially when the smoke started coming out of the back of Verstappen's car. And the first thing that entered my head was, my God, he's human after all.
Exactly. He's human, his mechanics are human, and the suppliers of the brakes are all human. And that's what it comes down to. And I think we were talking about this last week as well, that really the only thing that's going to stop Verstappen is some sort of a mechanical error or some weather-related an equalizer, normally the rain, but it was in this instance a mechanical issue. And you could see that he was not happy when he got into the garage. He went straight to the mechanics, had conversations with them, and I think that they have found out that it was to do with their setup. So they had set up slightly differently for quali, and it just did not suit the race setup. So on the formation app, he noticed something different, and then when he was on the grid, he noticed it stick. So although he's, I mean, there's nothing he could have done about it. He did his best. He had to retire the car. You could see as he was coming into the pit lane that whatever was left of the brake, it exploded on the way into the pit lane and blew it out. So it was a good decision to retire the car, because that could have caused a serious accident going around that track. And there's some very high-speed corners there too. Dangerous for himself, dangerous for spectators, and dangerous for the other cars out there as well. Now, he wasn't the only one to have to retire. We also seen Lewis Hamilton had an engine failure in lap 17, and he was going pretty well as well, considering that they're not in the fastest car this year. And on top of it, just to compound their woes over the weekend, George Russell crashed out on the very last lap. And that's led to some controversy as well, because it was deemed that Alonso could have potentially brake-checked Russell. So he slowed down a lot earlier than Russell would have been expecting, caused dirty air, which is a lot of turbulent air. And these cars are very sensitive to how the air flows through them. George Russell lost control of the car on the last lap, hits the wall. It was an incredibly scary crash. Now, it didn't come across like that on the live feed, but watching it back on F1's own feed, George Russell was screaming for a red flag. His car was on its side in the middle of the track, and they were very slow to make a decision about what was to happen. So you could hear multiple times he asked his race engineer to request a red flag, which means that the race will stop and the cars will have to slow right down and then come into the pit lane, which would have been the safest thing to do. But the stewards opted for a virtual safety car, which I've heard some commentators say that that probably wasn't enough. It was better than nothing, obviously. But considering that we've seen accidents in the past, fatal accidents where a car will get T-boned, so like a car in his position gets hit right in the middle by another car and it leaves him very exposed, he was probably right to scream for that red flag. But that was a bad weekend for Mercedes. Alonso did get penalised afterwards. He got a 20-second penalty added afterwards. There's a lot of controversy and talk about whether that was actually a penalty or whether he's entitled to drive how he deems fit. At the end of the day, he's not responsible for the car behind him, but some people have looked at the data and the telemetry and seen that he braked about 100 metres normally, 100 metres sooner than he normally would have. So there was a lot of talk about that, and it's still a topic for discussion even a week later.
Yeah, but you can understand why somebody would then raise their eyebrow and go, oh yeah, 100, yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? It does look very sus when you're breaking 100 metres before, when you're breaking 100 metres before your actual breaking point. You know, if that happened on the street out here, you'd want to thump the fella in front of you. So, I mean, in fairness, you have to say there's a little bit of justification in feeling that, you know, that you've just felt a bit cheated, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. And look, Alonso didn't come down the last shower. He knows what he's doing. Russell was gaining on him over the last few laps. They had a lot of, it was a lot of good racing between the two of them, but he was gaining, and for all intents and purposes, it did look like Russell would have caught him. And he tried something. And I do find it hard to believe that there was no malicious intent there. Now, I'm sure he didn't intend for Russell to crash in the way that he did, but it was no accident. You can see, if you look at the telemetry, how consistent he was lap after lap after lap leading up to that. And then the last lap breaks 100 metres earlier. Look, the stewards have seen it, and they've decided too that it was dangerous. Some people say that they're punishing the outcome more so than the actual incident itself. But it was deemed dangerous by the stewards, and that's the final ruling on it. I have seen, I think it was Eddie Jordan during the week, saying that he or Bernie Ecclestone, when he was in charge, was not a fan of these post-race penalties, that it's not fair on the drivers, that it's not fair on the journalists, that, like, you know, 2 hours after a race ends, these journalists have published their reports, and then all of a sudden the order has been changed, and they could be on a plane back home or whatever, and, you know, they've got editors looking at this saying that this is wrong. So there's a lot of discussion about it. Some very interesting topics and interesting, and of course it's you hear the views from either side, but yeah, everybody seems to have a different opinion, but it was dangerous.
Okay, forgive me for being slightly cynical when I say this, but I get the impression Drive to Survive is going to be very interesting for this particular season on that event alone. I'm not a big fan of the virtual safety car. I'd rather see the real thing out there, to be brutally honest. One of the big, and speaking of Drive to Survive and storylines, the fact that Sainz won after getting his appendix out just 16 days before, I mean, that's incredible.
That is huge. I mean, he was back at the track. So it is all happened in Saudi Arabia. He was back at the track a day after getting his appendix out. So he was there helping the engineers, you know, helping the likes of Ollie Bearman as well, who was his replacement at the time. He was told by the doctors, like, the day after, he's like, look, you can get up and go for a walk, you know, just kind of get moving again. And he said, well, if I'm going to walk around the hospital, I may as well walk around the paddock, and went straight back. So that guy is really dedicated to his craft and to his job. Now, he'd also know that having the likes of Ollie Bearman, this prodigy, in his seat while he's ill, he doesn't like that either. He wants to show that he's back there. But to come back 16 days later and to be as commanding as he was, he looked really comfortable out there. It was really nice to see the Ferraris. Both of them looked really good last weekend. It looks like they're on the way up, which would be nice to see somebody challenge the Red Bull. But it's an incredible story. I mean, this year Netflix has so much drama off the track. It was nice to actually see something happening on the track and a positive story in that as well. And, like, talking about Netflix, there was a discussion with one of the producers of Drive to Survive recently. They were asked about how they're going to handle the whole Christian Horner side of things, and that's going to be very interesting too, because they have to keep all parties happy. So we'll be glued to our seats to see how that plays out next year as well.
Oh, big time. Well, now that's Australia out of the way, and I was talking to a couple of friends of mine who live down there, and they would be more Australian touring car types, not big F1 fans. They love the track. They think it's absolutely perfect, but it's probably perfect for their kind of car and not for Formula One cars. Speaking of which, well, it's not the Australian touring cars, but tracks in general. We're now heading to Japan for a track that anybody who is a child of the 80s, myself included, would be very familiar with the old Scalextrics tracks, and it was always in this particular design, the figure of eight of Suzuka.
Yep, we're back, and I'm glad to see it. It's one of my favourite tracks. Technically, it's one of the most challenging on the calendar. It's got some of the fastest corners. It's got some beautiful series of S-shaped corners where you see those Formula One cars in all of their glory, stuck to the track like they're on rails. It's a test of every F1 driver's skill. They all love it. It feels like the track has been around for as long as F1 has, but it was only added to the track or the calendar in 1987. It was actually built in the 60s as a test track for Honda, and they were told that it was such a good track that they should open it up to other races. And then eventually in the 80s, Formula One came in and added it to the calendar. It's an incredible track. Like you said, it goes in a figure of eight. The track crosses over itself, which is definitely something quite unique to this F1 calendar. Look, it's another early race, but it's worth getting up for. Last year, look, it was no surprise Verstappen won it quite comfortably last year. But last year we also saw the two McLarens were right up there. It was Piastri's first podium. He came third and Norris came second. That was quite late in the season last year. We're a lot earlier with the Japanese GP this year. So I'd be keeping an eye out for those McLarens up there with the Ferraris, with the Red Bulls. I think this is going to be an incredible race. For anyone who hasn't watched it before, check out one of the second last corners, the 130R. It's one of the fastest corners on the circuit. You're going to see those cars reaching speeds of up to 190 miles an hour taking that corner. And immediately after that, you've got one of the slowest corners. We've got a chicane right before the last corner. So it makes for some really, really interesting driving. And if you're thinking about getting up early next weekend, this is definitely going to be worth it.
Can I ask, actually, because traditionally, Australia would be the first race of the season, Japan would be the last. Why come it so early this time?
So there's been a bit of a mix. They've mixed up the whole season, really. Next year, we're actually going back to the regular calendar. So Australia will be first again next year. I'm not entirely sure what the thinking was this year. I have heard different ideas around the logistics. So I suppose they're probably trying to group a lot of these races regionally. Because, I mean, the cost of moving like that amount of equipment to every race is substantial. It's quite high. So having a race in Australia, of course, Japan is probably one of the closest tracks. It makes sense to go there next. But then again, you've got the likes of Miami dotted in there, and then they're coming back to Italy for the Imola race. So I'm not 100% sure why that's happening, but I do believe that they're going back to kind of their regular slots next year. You're absolutely right. Japan is a lot earlier this year, which is making this very, very interesting because the cars have not changed that much since the last Japanese Grand Prix, which was only, I think, 4 or 5 months ago, maybe 6 months ago. So it was towards the end of last season. The cars are still pretty much the same, a few upgrades here and there. So this is going to be quite a close race. It's going to be interesting, depending on what the weather does as well. You can see there have been wet Japanese Grand Prix, and they can be dangerous. I think those, I suppose we have seen fatal crashes there in the past. I think in total there's been 19 drivers have lost their lives there. One, Jules Bianchi lost his life there in 2014, I believe, on a wet track and hit a recovery vehicle. So that place, it's a fast track, and in the wet, those races are quite dangerous. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Actually, just as you mentioned it seems to be traditionally a wet track. I wasn't old enough to remember, but I've seen it since, and anybody who's seen Rush will know what I'm talking about. Of course, James Hunt, Niki Lauda back in the 70s, it poured rain that day, so much so Lauda actually withdrew from the race. That was in 76 when Hunt won the world championship. But you mentioned Jules Bianchi's crash, absolutely horrific crash in 2014, and you're right about the fact that the rain, I don't know what it is, it just seems to be always raining when the race actually takes place. Something Eddie Irvine actually once remarked on as well, that he seemed to love about it. So I mean, this is one of those where drivers can either love it or hate it.
Absolutely. And to be honest, like, the impression that you get is that the drivers do love it. They love racing there. Obviously, they would prefer to be racing in safe conditions. I can't remember if it was the Japanese Grand Prix last year or another wet race where there was a safety vehicle on the track while the cars were following the safety car. And at the time, I do believe it was Pierre Gasly. He had to pit. He was left behind, and what they asked the drivers to do is to catch up with the safety car, with the queue behind it. And as he was catching up, he wasn't told that there was a recovery vehicle, and he narrowly missed it. And so there are still, like, although it's a lot safer than even when Jules Bianchi had his fatal accident, it's a lot safer now that we have the halo and the cockpits and the monocoques are a lot better. They're a lot better built. There are still elements of danger there, like a huge element of danger in that you've got these super high speed, powerful vehicles. They could hit marshals, they could hit other recovery vehicles. So that's what makes the rain quite scary, is that the visibility is poor. I don't know if you've, for anybody who's new to Formula One, watching a wet race is a display of skill. Like, considering the range of visibility they have, the spray that's coming off the cars and the speed they're going. If you've ever driven on the motorway on a wet day and you see that the rain being sprayed or the car in front of you, or even if you get a good view of it when you're following a lorry, and the spray coming up, it's difficult to see. But if you were doing that at 190 miles an hour and you're far lower to the ground, it's incredibly challenging.
Yeah, you don't have the wipers or the window in front of you either to do you any kind of favours. Before we leave Japan, Yuki Tsunoda, it's a home race for him in form. You're predicting a top 10 finish. Are we expecting a bit of a kind of a home success in some ways? I mean, okay, they mightn't win the races, but could we see maybe someone making a name for themselves, going out to make a name for themselves as it is a home Japan, a home Grand Prix?
Yeah, look, Yuki Tsunoda, he's had a good start to the season. He's had a good start, but you can only really compare him to his teammate. His teammate at the moment is Daniel Ricciardo, who's not had a good start by his standards. And it's concerning because he had a poor run of form when he was in McLaren. He came back last year to replace Nyck de Vries, and he had an injury in Zandvoort where he injured his wrist. He was replaced by Liam Lawson, who looked incredible. And then he got a seat back for the last few races. He's come back and not had much of an impact, but Yuki has really grown and kind of evolved with the car. He's been with that team for a few years now. It's under new management. We've got Lauren Mekies in there. He's come in from Ferrari. He's now a team principal at the RB Visa. I'm going to get the name wrong. They have a nice long name this year, but Yuki is on form. He had an incredible race in Australia. He was very consistent. He seemed to have gotten... He's quite fiery. So off track, he's quite quiet. In the car, he's a different story. He seems to have gotten that under control. I think success for Yuki this weekend is going to be a top 10 finish in a quite competitive field in terms of like having the two Red Bulls, the two Ferraris and two McLarens. And, you know, we've got Aston Martin and Mercedes all kind of hovering around there. But I think we'll see Yuki get into the top 10. He will be driven by the fact that he is at home. We've also got a Japanese driver, Iwasu. He's going to be coming in for FP1, so the first practice session. There is a requirement each of these Formula 1 teams do have to run a junior driver for at least one session every year. He's going to be replacing Daniel Ricciardo for the first free practice session. Now, he won't be in the race, but he is definitely one of the future stars to watch out for as well. But yeah, Yuki Tsunoda, a top 10 finish, I'm going to predict that. You heard it here first, I guess.
Yeah, well, next weekend I can ask you because, of course, it's on at 6 a.m. next Sunday morning. Just before we go further, I want to we've got other things to want to touch on, and there's one thing I'm really fascinated about that you've sent me information on: a possible combination weekend, shall we say, between the motorbikes and the cars. But P1 predicts your stats from yesterday. I didn't get to that. I want to get to that now if I could. I'd say a lot of people's predictions kind of might have went out the window a little bit, or if they avoided Verstappen, they were quids in.
Yeah. Well, I think we had 90% of people predicted a Verstappen win, so we had 90% of people were wrong. Of course, I was one of them. I thought Verstappen would have been quite comfortable. Nobody predicted Carlos Sainz to win. Anyone who hadn't predicted Verstappen, I think the rest had actually gone for Charles Leclerc. So Sainz kind of came out of the woodwork there. Nobody was watching him. Dark horse, I guess people were like, me included. I had him in the top five, but I didn't have him for a win or even a podium. I thought the injury would have slowed him down, but it hadn't. Again, we had a lot of people. I think 70% of people thought Verstappen would get the fastest lap. Again, that didn't happen because he was out so early. So these kind of incidents do make it incredibly interesting. You've got the people who take the risk. We'll get highly rewarded on a weekend like this, but we didn't see anybody this weekend predict all five in the right order in the top five. That's an incredibly difficult thing to do. We didn't see it happen at all last year. We've had a few fours this year already, which is very impressive. Last year we had a few fours as well, and only once in the last 2 years has anyone predicted top five of any race. And you're talking to him right now, not to blow my own trumpet, but it was me. And it's gonna happen again this year. I can feel it.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. Now, I want to, before we wrap up, a couple of things we need to talk about. And that is this story, as I just touched it a little bit earlier on, about Liberty Media. They're the American outfit that own F1, and they've decided, they've bid to buy, and this is, if you're a motorbike fan, you need to keep an ear on this, because they're bidding to buy MotoGP, which is the two-wheel equivalent of Formula 1, and we could have shared race weekends. That would be mind-blowing.
It would be incredible. Incredible for both sports. Now, this is an ongoing development. They have a $4.4 billion bid in to purchase MotoGP. And part of that vision that they have is that they want to prove something. Liberty Media want to prove that the success that they've had in Formula One, and like a lot of that success in the last few years is definitely down to the Netflix series. Like, that has brought in a whole new audience. It's revamped and refreshed F1. They want to try and replicate that in the two-wheel version, in MotoGP. So that's part of that. And then, since they'll own both of these parties, bringing them together and having joint race weekends, this would be incredible. I mean, you're going to have a blend of the two-wheel supporters and four-wheel all brought together. If you think about it, in the track, I mean, they do race in a lot of the same tracks. I think MotoGP were only over in Kota, over in the States last weekend, and the Formula One will be there later in the year. It would be incredible to see this. Whether this works out or not is another thing, but it would be, and I would say there's a lot of people will be in favour of this joint kind of venture that's coming up.
Well, and then it's interesting that you note that the Kota was on last weekend, because of course that was NASCAR also racing there last weekend, their first road course event of the season. So it does show it can be done, and you can get massive, they're getting, got an enormous crowd. And also some top quality racing, it has to be said as well. What's this about Toto name checking Verstappen?
Absolutely, Toto Wolff. I mean, if anybody has watched Drive to Survive, or even if you just keep up to speed or up to date with Formula One online on different blogs and news, they go at each other all the time. Now, Toto Wolff has mentioned Max Verstappen as a possible replacement for Lewis Hamilton. Now, you have to question his intentions here. Is he saying it to twist the knife that, you know, Christian Horner already feels? Is he saying it as a genuine interest that he has? The same time, you have to take it with a pinch of salt, because he's also mentioned Alonso, and he's mentioned their prodigy that they have, Antonelli. Now, the question is here, do they invest in this youthful prodigy that they have coming up, who's currently in F2 or F3, I can't remember. Do they invest in him, or do they go with a seasoned veteran? There's talk that the reason that Hamilton wasn't offered a longer contract was so that Antonelli would stay interested and wouldn't jump ship to another team. So do you fill his seat with Verstappen? What happens to Antonelli? Question marks there. There's talk that he'd go and fill one of the Williams seats, who are a sister team to Mercedes as well, who supply the engines. But what would have to happen for Verstappen to leave Red Bull? What would have to happen for him to go to Mercedes? It's a big, big jump, because especially considering the rivalry that's been there. To me, it would have to be money. There would have to also be a very clear plan. I think if Helmut Marko was to leave Red Bull and go to Mercedes, I think you see Verstappen going then. You've also got the likes of Adrian Newey, who has been in discussion or has been in the news this week about having received a potential offer from Aston Martin, who's gotten a lot of money in from Saudi Arabia recently. Could Verstappen go there with Adrian Newey? We don't know. This is all set to play out. It's going to make the rest of the season incredibly interesting. Will Verstappen still be at Red Bull at the end of this year? I don't know. I think it's all going to depend on whether Christian Horner stays or goes. And there has been talk in the last week as well that he could become a majority shareholder in the Red Bull racing team. But we have to see how all of that plays out as well.
Okay, we see what happens with that. Let's keep an eye on the Irish guys who are trying to make the push in towards Formula One. And, let's look at Brandon McLaughlin. Good start to his GB4 career.
Absolutely. He's had an incredible weekend. His first year, his first season in the slicks and wings. And on Thursday, there were their first testing session. He tops the timing charts in a wet session, which is incredible considering this is his first season in GB4. He goes on to finish third in the race yesterday, beaten by Alicia Palmowski, who had an incredible race, and she has gotten the attention now of ex-Formula 1 drivers and F1 Academy Susie Wolf. She's definitely one to watch. She had a very comfortable race, a great start. Also interesting to note, this is her first ever season in a single-seater race as well. So that was incredible. Brandon McCaughan right up there. His teammate was second. He was third. He looked really comfortable. Those three drivers were head and shoulders above the rest of the field. He is again, they have their second race tomorrow, and he qualified P1 again yesterday for the race tomorrow. So this guy is good. This is his first season in GB4, and he is well up there. We're going to see big things from him this year.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens. Just to remind everybody, qualification starts 7 a.m. on Saturday morning for the Japanese Grand Prix. The race itself is at 6 a.m. So, Dara, if it's okay with you, we might meet up again next Sunday afternoon and talk
Absolutely.
About what's been, hopefully will be a great, I'm Suzuka, I love the track. It's just one of those, call me a bit of an old stager at this stage, but there's just something special about that race and the big old Fuji TV signs and everything that goes with it. So maybe that's just me being old fashioned. Dara, thanks so much for joining us.
Cheers, John. Thank you.
Take it easy.